because we're told of so many problems and issues around the world, like we just get overwhelmed. And if you tell someone, okay, this is what's going on and this is what you can do, that's a bit different. People are like, okay, that's actionable.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. Today's conversation is with Amanda Hurst. Amanda is co-founder of WellBeings, an organization that unites animal welfare and environmental protection throughout the globe, from closing down puppy mills in the American South to stopping deforestation in South America. She's also co-founder of the luxury sustainable fashion retailer Maison de Mode. They've recently launched a cruelty-free edit that everyone should check out. Amanda, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Beth.
Of course. I would love to start, go back and talk about your life growing up. Were there animals in it? And what was your relationship to them? How did this path begin and when?
Yeah, no, it's funny because I was born and raised in Manhattan, which is not known for animals or the environment. You know, it's very much a hard city. But I grew up with a mother who loved animals, and so we always were adopting pets. She'd take me to the country a lot, and when I was 14, she bought a farm in Long Island. And so from that age onward, we had a farm growing up. We would always adopt animals, like goats and alpaca. Yeah, so she...
Really?
Yeah, it's a fun place to visit. You should come one time, for sure.
I would love to.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of animals there?
Yeah, there's always a rotation. My mom is a big bird person, so we have a lot of different types of chickens and ducks and geese. And then we also have alpaca, different types of goats, and then, of course, dogs, cats. Growing up on that farm was sort of the beginning of kind of a charitable, empathetic look at animals.
And then later as an adult, when did you first start your work as an activist for animal rights?
About 10 years ago, I started working in New York. I was 25 and I was working at a magazine called Marie Claire. And I had just bought my dog, Finn, from a pet store. And I knew a bit about this issue of puppy mills, which are essentially illegal breeding facilities in America where most of the dogs at pet stores come from. So at these puppy mills, they have breeding dogs that they'll breed to death or not usually not treat well. And then they have litter after litter after litter, and the puppies get sold for a lot of money. And since I knew that most dogs from pet stores were from puppy mills, I was not planning on getting a dog from a pet store, but I kept seeing this dog in the window, little tan chihuahua looking dog. And I went in and I asked them all these questions. I was like, okay, so where do you get your dogs? And they're like, no, we only work with reputable breeders. Like, here's this family tree. They gave me all this information and links and stuff. And so I was like, okay, you know, this sounds legit. I'm going to get him. So I got my dog, Finn.
And when was this?
So he's 12. So that would be 2008. I got him. I loved him. Then simultaneously, I was thinking, okay, I also want to start collaborating with an animal welfare charity. I was starting to research, and then the Humane Society reached out to me, and they were like, someone mentioned your name. It was very serendipitous. They were like, yeah, you know, we want to do our first event in New York, and someone mentioned your name, that you're a big animal lover. We'd love to talk with you more. And in the process of talking about their first event in New York, I gave them the paperwork that I'd gotten from the pet store. And I was like, do you mind just tracing this and letting me know for sure he's from a legit breeder? And they did. And he was from this horrible puppy mill in Tennessee.
Oh.
I know. And they've been trying to close it forever. And it's been on the radar of all these nonprofits. I was like, oh my God. So I even asked the right questions and they lied to me. And, you know, I love my dog and he's great and he's safe. But his mother and father probably are not.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that when I was talking to Humane Society, that issue was at the forefront of my mind. And so we started working together to raise money and awareness to end puppy mills in America.
Did you go see any puppy mills while you were doing this?
Yeah, I went to about 6 in total, which was like interesting, very traumatic. I'm definitely the type of person that's going to like cry the whole time.
Wait, can you just go?
Not really. So I don't know if they like, you know, pulled some strings. I don't think it's always the safest of places, especially where like if you the way that you raid a puppy mill, it's a little bit like trespassing. So technically someone could pull a gun out.
Right.
And especially, you know, it was like North Carolina, Mississippi, Arizona. It's definitely hardcore environments. And I actually went with my co-founder of Wellbeings, Brianna, on one of them also. What eventually happened was I started Friends of Finn. Friends of Finn was a group within the Humane Society of the United States dedicated to ending puppy mills within the United States. So we were able to go on these puppy mill raids.
What was it like the first time? What did you see?
So the first time that I went to a puppy mill, it was in North Carolina, and I actually went with my friend Georgina Bloomberg, who is also a huge animal lover and a much stronger person than I am, emotionally at least. We took an early flight to get to North Carolina, and it was a private residence. And first of all, in the residence, so it was a couple that were grandparents, and they lived with their granddaughter, who was like 15. We went into the house. They weren't there. We were with the police and the Humane Society. And the smell of urine, like ammonia, like blinded me, first of all. I was like, how are these people living here in this house? And then you see, like, first dog I see is, you know, chained to a chair and it can't even stand because the chain is so short. And then there are just all these other dogs running around in the living room. The bedroom doors are closed and they have a newspaper shoved under the door so that they don't smell the urine when they're sleeping. The living conditions were really odd.
Oh my God.
Yeah. In their backyard, they had 3 sections and it was divided by breed. So there was like Chihuahua section, Dachshund section, and then maybe like Pomeranian or something else. The dogs were in really horrible conditions. And I remember one dog had a twig. It was stuck in its, what you call it, the roof of your mouth. And it had been there 3 years, the vet judged. It's just living with this thing stuck in its roof of its mouth and totally malnourished, eye conditions, teeth conditions. We sort of helped the vet team do their assessments, which ones have to go to the emergency vet, which ones can, you know, stay the night in this temporary shelter. I'm bawling, crying, trying to help these people. And Georgina is like ready to fight the people that are in the house. I'm like, oh my God, this is so emotional. I want to take all these animals. And there were like over 100 animals. And then the man of the house, he came back. He was so pissed. He was yelling at all of us. The weird thing was that he knew, like, they had named every animal, which wow. Also confused me because in this weird way, I do think you like them, but you're also treating them so poorly. It was like this weird situation where on one hand, I hated them, but on the other hand, I kind of had this understanding of, you know, they couldn't have lived in poorer conditions, and this was a way that they found to make money. And I do think at the root of it, do love animals, but it had spiraled.
Yeah.
And that can happen where with hoarding too, for example, it comes from one place, but then it, you know, when the money gets into play and you get more and more animals and you can't take care of those animals and you lack the education to know how to take care of animals, it can get to that situation. It was hard to see that, but it was also encouraging to know that all the animals were taken out. Then I went on a few other ones.
Which must have been hard to keep going after. I'm sure it was traumatizing the first time to go back and go back. Right.
Yeah, no, I don't know how individuals that do this type of thing for a living, rescue work.
Yeah.
Because it is so intense to deal with so much pain and emotion on such a level. And of course, not all the animals survive. It's not a happy thing to do or see. But it is always good to know that at least in the ones that I was involved in, that all the animals got out and that most of them survived and found homes.
I think as a society, we really know now, like puppy mills are bad and dogs that cost $4,000 or $6,000 usually come from a puppy mill, or, you know, the pet store $3,000 French bulldog probably comes from a puppy mill, but there's still a disconnect. And even, I think there's even a disconnect for people to actually really know what a puppy mill is. They just know puppy mill bad. You know, there's something that people don't want to see.
And I think another thing when there's that disconnect is because when people see animals in pet stores, sometimes they think they're rescuing the animal from the pet store. And so that can be a little confusing too. They're like, well, if I don't adopt it, then no one's going to adopt it. And then what happens? And it's like, yeah, but the problem is if you support pet stores, then they're going to keep sourcing these dogs from the puppy mill. So you're supporting that industry.
Right.
And there's so many dogs in shelters. So the solution really should be that pet stores don't exist, or that they only sell dogs that are rescues.
Absolutely. They do look so pathetic in those windows and those tiny little, like, it looks hot and they're like in like paper in the window. And it just happened that in New York, it's not legal anymore. I mean, that's really recent.
I know. And it's exciting, but it took a while.
It took a really long time.
Yeah.
You're doing this with the Humane Society and you meet Brianna. And so how did you guys decide, okay, we're going to do Fin to Fin?
We picked the name Fin to Fin Alliance because my dog was named Fin and her first dog that she ever had was named Fin also. So we picked that name, and the first campaign was equine welfare. What we learned is that 130,000 horses are slaughtered every year. Yeah. So it's illegal in America, but we ship the horses to Canada and Mexico, and then around 130,000 horses are slaughtered for dog food or human food. That was our first campaign.
Well, and the horse issue too, anyone outside of the horse world has no idea that these horses are being like put on trucks, jammed in there for days at a time.
And that they're often healthy horses that could have a purpose. They could provide animal therapy for war right. vets. There are all these programs in America where they could have a function, but it's just the system isn't in place and people don't know about it. The second year, we're still, you know, figuring out ourselves. And we're like, okay, well, we kind of want, when we talk, we're realizing it's not just animals that we're really talking about anymore. We're talking about animals and the environment and humans. You know, we've broadened our scope of work. And yeah. So it was really that idea of interconnection, how animal welfare affects human health, affects the planet, affects animal welfare. In 2019, when we officially came out as Well-Beings, because we thought that was a more inclusive name
yes.
for,
yes.
you know, caring about the well-being of all life on Earth and celebrating the interconnection of that life. In 2019, the campaign was the human-animal bond.
What was the campaign?
We started to come across all these programs where they're called animal-assisted interventions.
Yeah.
So it's like animal therapy, humane education, any sort of programming that uses animals in a way to help humans. We identified four charities that we wanted to partner with and support their work. Two were animal-assisted therapy programs. One was called Squirrelwood Equine Sanctuary, and so that was horses and war vets. Tony La Russa's ARF Foundation, which is in San Francisco, that was rescue dogs and war vets. And then we had a humane education program called HEART, and then URI, PALS program, which is one of the most unknown programs. And that was keeping victims of domestic violence with their pets.
Usually what they have to, they end up in going, like having to leave, and then they're in a shelter and the shelter won't take the pet.
Yeah, well, so in cases of domestic abuse in the United States, only 3% of domestic abuse shelters allow pets.
Oh my God, that's nuts.
I know, it's crazy. And so what happens is normally women, but these individuals stay in the situation of abuse longer than they should because they don't want to leave their pets. So,
especially with an abuser, right?
Exactly, because then you know the pet is being abused or is going to be abused as well. So you stay in that situation longer than you should. So this program, URI PALS, they are setting up shelters where you can take your pets.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think that that's revolutionary and something that really should be highlighted so that people know there are places you can take your pets and you can get out of those situations. And so for 2019, those were our four charity partners.
This year, your campaign for 2020.
Yeah.
This wonderful year we're having.
The craziest year of our lives, known as 2020. Our well-beings campaign is protecting the Amazon in Bolivia. It's a deforestation campaign. The Amazons are incredibly important on the planet and something that can very clearly be explained to impact animals, humans, and climate change.
The Amazon everywhere is in really bad shape. But what's happening in Bolivia?
Brianna and I flew down to Bolivia in February of this year, right before everything shut down. What's happening in Bolivia is what's happening in Brazil. So Brazil gets a ton of attention, as it should. It's a bigger country. Most of the Amazons are there. But that deforestation and the rampant fires are also happening in Bolivia at arguably a faster rate. And for the same reasons, which is primarily the cattle industry. And you know, they cut down the trees to create plots of land for cattle and other agriculture. That can often lead to fires. It's a sad cycle that ultimately affects the locals, animals, and people, and then affects climate change around the world. So what we did was visit a few animal sanctuaries down there and a few indigenous communities to learn the animal part as well as the social part.
What'd you learn?
From the indigenous communities, we learned is that the entrepreneurship that they have has to do with using resources from the land, but in a sustainable way. So it's not just cutting down trees. For instance, the community we visited, they were taking out a resin from the trees and making some beauty products from it, but then also protecting the forest. So it was a sustainable situation that was giving them a revenue, but also protecting the local Amazon. And so we wanted to encourage that. And so that was one partner called ABCOB that we eventually partnered with. So it's supporting indigenous farmers and communities. And then the sanctuaries. The sanctuary that we ended up partnering with is called Senda Verde. And they're the biggest sanctuary in Bolivia. They have over 800 animals. And it was unlike any sanctuary or shelter that I've ever been to, because it's built around like the forest in Amazon. And it's built in a way so that actually, it sounds kind of weird, but where humans are kind of in the cages and the animals are free.
How? Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was weird and also revolutionary, because it just basically, we're walking through these kind of tunneled pathways made of the fencing.
And, so you're encased in enclosures, kind of?
Yeah, and you're walking through these paths, and then the animals have these huge open spaces, a lot of them not enclosed at all. Like the monkeys are pretty free reign. They just noticed, and the birds and the monkey, they all just noticed to stay nearby at this point because that's where the food is. The jaguars and the pumas were totally enclosed. It was amazing to see those animals and to understand the local animal welfare issues, because most of the animals there honestly were from habitat loss because of the fires and then also wildlife trafficking.
All these animals are on the extinction is not far away for a lot of them. Did that fire you guys up?
Whenever you see an issue firsthand, you always care more and you feel more invested in it. And that's why we went on that trip, even though it was like so hard to get to. It was like 5 flights. And then we're taking these like scary little planes across the country that are, you know, I don't know, from the 60s and have never been repaired. I'm like, if I die, I guess, is this a good story? I don't know. Like, it was for a good cause and we learned so much. And so I think that it certainly brought the issue of Amazonian deforestation home for us. And then our challenge once we got home was, how do we tell this story so that people care?
Yeah, absolutely. And so how do you?
When COVID happened, we were like, do we change our campaign? Like, what do we do? But then we realized that actually our campaign tied into the issues related to COVID, because as many people probably know, COVID jumped from an animal to a human in China, they believe. So, and that has to do with wildlife trafficking. And that's also a huge issue in Bolivia. A lot of deforestation is also to capture animals. And then also what we originally wanted to talk about, which is still a main focus, is climate change. Well, the Amazon consume carbon, they store carbon. And when we're cutting these trees down, we're just losing that ally to combat climate change and the excess of carbon in the atmosphere. And that we're losing the Amazon at a rate so fast that if we lose 5% more, they're saying that the Amazon will start converting into a savanna. and it won't be able to sustain itself. And, you know, that's sort of the end of our fight against climate change. We lose the Amazon, we lose the fight against climate change.
Yeah. Pandemics happen mostly because of how we treat animals.
And I think the second part to that is, like, because we're told of so many problems and issues around the world, like, we just get overwhelmed. And if you tell someone, okay, this is what's going on and this is what you can do, that's a bit different. People are like, okay, that's actionable. We were saying, eat less red meat. Okay, well, like, stop supporting the cattle industry. Switch to a more vegetarian diet if you can. These are brands we like. These are ways we like to do it. You know, just giving people a positive, actionable approach to these issues versus, like, this is terrible, it's on fire, be as depressed as we are. Like, that is never helpful.
It doesn't work. And the eating less meat is something people can do every day. Mm-hmm. Like, it's something you are really in control of and have power over. And our diets are destroying the world. So it's really, you know, it's personal. So you're busy because you're also the co-founder and chief brand officer of the luxury ethical fashion retailer, Maison de Mode. Will you talk about that a little bit and how that started? And it's awesome. It's just beautiful. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on there this week. So.
Oh, I appreciate that. When I started working and I started working with the Humane Society, I was writing a page for Marie Claire about responsible fashion, which wasn't like a huge topic at that time. I connected to a friend who had a sustainable luxury line, and we started doing these pop-ups with the concept of showcasing our favorite sustainable fashion brands. And so the first one, we only had 6 brands, but we had a bit of success. We kept doing it for a few years, and then we decided to launch the website. And so that's where we are at today. We have over 80 different brands, and it's an exciting moment because I feel like, especially in the fashion industry, everyone is talking about sustainability.
I think some people are confused because sustainable has been a weird word for a long time, mm-hmm. and people have kind of used it when they shouldn't be. What does it take to be one of the 80 that you guys have?
Yeah. So how I define sustainable fashion is fashion that takes into account the environment and takes into account the people that are making the clothes. So there's the environmental component and then the social component. And so on Maison de Mode, what we do is we have a system of icons, and we apply the icons to brands so you know what kind of sustainability we're talking about. The cruelty-free edit has been of great interest to a lot of people.
Have you noticed since you started, there's been more and more demand for sustainable and for cruelty-free?
Definitely in the past 2 years especially has been this growth in interest for sustainable fashion. But actually, from we started the website in 2015, one of the most searched terms on our website was vegan. That it did kind of make sense to me because when it comes to especially animal welfare issues, people that dress cruelty-free, they really care about that and are looking for that and are not going to compromise on that. So when we realized there is this community of people that are trying to dress that way, we took note of it. And that's why this year we finally launched this edit when we felt like there were enough brands that were strong and in that cruelty-free space.
That's really new too, right? The cruelty-free fashion world has been a little limited.
To say the least. Yeah.
And so tell me about some of the new brands and what you're excited about.
Shoes are the trickiest for evening wear. There's a brand called AERA, Ira. And they're great for heels and boots and evening wear shoes. For day wear, a boot brand called Allison Whittles, we're partnering with them, Wellbeings, and we're going to actually design a style specific to Wellbeings. And then for bags, Rothy's, I don't know if you know that shoe brand.
Yeah, I know Rothy's.
So they launched bags just now, and they're really cute. And then the faux furs, and also even, you know, because cashmere, wool, silk are byproducts of animals. So we also have good alternatives to those that, you know, incorporate piece silk and things of that nature.
And are those worlds growing in the terms of, like, brands starting to do more with alternatives to wool?
Honestly, I think that the innovations in alternative leathers, so like pineapple leather and mushroom leather and all these, that's where we've really seen development, but not as much with wool and cashmere. So, you know, but again, it's a process. And I think ultimately what's developed in a lab will probably have better performance, be more cost efficient for brands than using animals. And so I think that is just the direction that brands will all go at the end of the day.
And that's coming soon. I mean, we're not that far from scaling that stuff.
But. Yeah, I mean, they're growing fur in labs now. So I think that the future is now, and it's just a matter of getting these products to market.
Amanda, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
To learn more about Amanda, about Well-Beings, and Maison de Mode, go to our website. It's speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, we'd greatly appreciate it. Please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people to find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate that too. We're on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Gabriella Sibilska, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.